This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Hello, Next Picture Show listeners. Here's a friendly reminder that if you enjoy the Next Picture Show, you'll really enjoy getting more Next Picture Show by subscribing to our Patreon. You can get our weekly newsletter for $3 a month and unlock bonus episodes for $5 a month. We finally got around to posting our discussion of Onward and the State of Pixar today, and we're currently working on an episode about parental philosophy and introducing your kids to movies. To subscribe to our Patreon, please visit patreon.com/nextpictureshow.
Difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
You believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome to the Next Picture Show, a movie of the week podcast that's usually devoted to a classic film and how it's shaped our thoughts on a recent release. I'm Tasha Robinson, here with
Genevieve Koski,
Scott Tobias,
and Keith Phipps.
Now, normally, this is where we do a little bit of mildly comedic nonsense leading up to the reveal of a specific movie pairing we're going to be discussing. Then we tell you what those two movies have in common and how we're going to be comparing them over the course of a couple of podcasts. But this week, we're breaking the rules and the usual format. This week, we're doing a one-off self-contained episode. No pairing, though we'll probably get into a lot of comparisons. And that's because this past week, some of our favorite movies became widely available for the first time, not just as repertory release favorites or home Blu-ray purchases, but readily accessible in streaming format. This is the year that Japan's beloved Studio Ghibli fully enters the online age. Fans of this podcast are probably fairly familiar with at least some of Studio Ghibli's work, like the Oscar winner Spirited Away or the unbeatable children's classic My Neighbor Totoro. Serious animation fans have probably dug deeper into the Ghibli library, into the breakout environmental fairy tale drama Princess Mononoke, or maybe the Disney home video releases of Castle in the Sky or Kiki's Delivery Service. Or, for even more serious animation buffs, their stylistic experiments like The Tale of the Princess Kiyuga or My Neighbors the Yamadas. Ghibli has released 21 feature films so far, with studio co-founder Hayao Miyazaki currently very slowly at work on a 22nd. But until just a few months ago, you could only see these movies either by buying discs for home viewing or by being lucky enough to catch them at special theatrical events or at festivals. Ghibli's movies are masterworks of 2D cel animation, with deep, lush backgrounds and vivid imagery. They're made with an attention to craft and detail that was particularly rare when the studio launched 35 years ago and is just about unheard of now, when most studios have either moved over to computer-generated animation or are operating on a fast-paced pipeline that doesn't allow for Ghibli's focus on handmade work. And part of that obsession with traditional craftsmanship has been a conviction that films don't belong on streaming services, where it's harder to control the quality. We'll get into how that changed, talk about where to find Ghibli films, and focus in on one of them in particular, after this.
To try to use the crystal power for selfish reasons will bring great unhappiness.
You know, the odds are against you.
They simply don't understand. The same technology that kept Laputa airborne also made it a major power that once dominated the entire planet.
Shoot anyone who resists!
What will we do?
Come on. Beyond that cloud is a floating city that no one here on Earth believes exists.
We're going in!
We have an emergency.
Hands up!
The way to Laputa has been opened!
Arrest him!
Please let me come with you, I need to save her!
I tell you, this thing is alive!
Stop it, you're destroying everything!
Listen, we can understand.
So what changed for Studio Ghibli movies? December 2019 was the first year the studio made its films available for digital rental, and this spring they've been rolling out for Netflix viewers around the world. In America, though, the new streaming service HBO Max got the exclusive streaming license, so the films are available there. Either way, streaming access means Ghibli movies are now much more available to viewers around the world than they've ever been before, and millions of people who've never seen them will finally have the chance to. Why the change? Producer Toshio Suzaki, one of the original founders of Studio Ghibli and its longtime public face, told Entertainment Weekly in March that it was because of an interview he saw with Woody Allen, of all people. Allen was talking about making a film entirely for streaming services because of the audience accessibility it would have. Suzuki says that thinking about that film, and thinking about opening up Ghibli's work to a wider audience, became a compelling prospect. He's also hinted at another reason for the digital availability, though. As I said before, Miyazaki is working on yet another film, but his laborious, time-intensive work process means that movie won't be available for a few more years at least, and the studio hasn't put out a new film since 2014's When Marnie Was There. So the financial boost of selling the studio's streaming rights was likely an incentive. Whatever the reason, we really don't mind. We're just happy to finally have more access to these films. Some of us grew up in an era when they weren't available at all in America, and we watched as they made clumsy inroads into the country, first given tepid theatrical runs by Walt Disney Studios, which didn't give them much marketing push, and then coming to DVD in bolderized, rewritten forms. When New York distribution company G-Kids picked up the release rights and started producing higher quality dubs and discs, that was a relief, but it still left Ghibli's movies as boutique features for DVD collectors. Now, at least outside the US, they're going to be very easy to find on Netflix. The problem is that they're also likely to disappear into the giant pit of Netflix offerings, like so many other titles. So we decided to sit down and talk about our personal Ghibli experiences and recommendations, starting with a more in-depth look at the studio's very first film, Hayao Miyazaki's Castle in the Sky. Miyazaki had already directed a couple of films before Castle in the Sky, starting with The Castle of Cagliostro, a feature film adventure for Lupin the Third, the gentleman crook main character of an anime TV show that Miyazaki worked on in the 1970s. He followed that up with Nausicaa of the Valley of the Wind, a partial adaptation of a fantasy manga epic he was working on in the 1980s. The success of that movie gave him and his TV partner Isao Takahata, along with Suzuki and producer Yasuyoshi Takuma, the clout that they needed to found Ghibli, and 1986's Castle in the Sky was the proof of concept the studio needed. That's where the Ghibli story started, so that's where we're going to start in this special one-off episode devoted to Ghibli magic.
So, you're not interested in money, but you want to find out the truth about Laputa. Well, I guess there's worse reasons for you wanting to become a pirate.
Mother, I say let him come along!
Toe the line and work harder. Overboard you go.
Yes, Captain.
Yes! No more swabbing the decks! Hooray!
I won't have to wash the dishes!
I've peeled my last potato! Sheena, can you make pudding? I love pudding! I get to lick the spatula!
And I like chocolate cake with that... Oh, what's that frosting? It's kind of pink and swirly.
Will you shut up? Ah, what can I tell you? They just really like dessert.
Whew. Wow, I've been talking a lot. Let's hear from you guys. What's your history with Castle in the Sky, and what's your history with Ghibli in general?
I think we're all new to Castle in the Sky, right, guys?
I'm ashamed to admit it, but yeah, it's the first time seeing Castle in the Sky.
That is wild.
New to me as well.
Mm-hmm. That ashamed to admit it feeling is something I come up against a lot with Ghibli, because like I've seen a fair amount, but there's also some big ones I haven't seen, and I blame that partially on the availability issues you've been talking about, Tasha, but also just I've missed some big ones, and I feel bad about that.
Well, I also feel like watching this movie, it's kind of like, oh, wait, I never listened to the Beatles.
Right, yeah.
This is where everything comes from. I get it now, you know?
Yeah,
I haven't seen a bunch of his other movies, but still, it felt very much like, oh, this is like mission statement, and here's what it's all going to be about. And you can kind of follow various strands of this through his other films.
Yeah, it's such a keystone kind of work. There's so many nascent pieces of Miyazaki in particular, like the sort of the Ghibli design and the Ghibli mindset in here, but like Miyazaki's obsessions in general. But what's it like? I mean, this was one of my very earliest Ghiblis. I saw Totoro first and Grave of the Fireflies also very, very early on when it came to the United States, like almost immediately after its Japanese release. But I'm not having the experience of coming to Castle in the Sky for the first time after seeing like something much more sophisticated and like late in the game, like Spirited Away. What's it like to see this film for the first time now?
I mean, I would echo what Keith said in terms of just seeing it and understanding how Miyazaki and Ghibli sort of evolved from that moment. And in my view, kind of refined it a lot too, in terms of kind of understanding, you know, finding a voice and kind of working certain elements that are in Castle in the Sky come into play, you know, in later films and Spirited Away and, you know, Howl's Moving Castle, especially Princess Mononoke, all that stuff. You could see all of the germs of all that, the roots of all those movies in Castle in the Sky. So it was kind of exciting to watch in that respect, while also feeling, I do still feel like it's a somewhat of a rough draft. I did like the film, but I'm going to guess maybe a little bit less than everyone else. I struggled with a lot of it. I struggled with kind of sorting through it. Well, the pleasures for me of watching a Miyazaki film is engaging with the sort of dream logic that he sets up. It kind of allows you to sort of meander through an unconventional kind of abstract world. And I found myself struggling more so to do that in Castle in the Sky than I would with some of the films he did later.
Why is that? Is it because it's so episodic? Is it because there's not enough dreamlike qualities to it?
Yeah, probably both. It felt a little busy and misshapen, particularly the second act. I think before it has such a very strong start. And then I think before you finally get to the castle, the events leading up to that moment, the film lost me a little bit. But it got me back.
I can't believe I'm going to say this, Scott, but wow, do I disagree with you? There's a sequence in the second act that is maybe my favorite part of the film, but we'll get to that. Genevieve, you say you still haven't watched some of the big ones. Does this play for you like nascent Miyazaki, like early Ghibli? Like, do you get that same Keystone feeling, or do you feel like you're coming into this one at the right time?
It's interesting because listening to Scott talk, I was thinking if I had come to this movie at a different point in my Ghibli viewing, or honestly just a different point in my life, I may have liked it less than I did. But at this particular moment in time, for a lot of extra-textual reasons, this was like the exact type of Ghibli movie I needed right now. Like, most of the Ghiblis I've seen skew more toward the, I guess you could say, sophisticated side, more adult side, like Mononoke, Grave of the Fireflies. Those were my introductions to Studio Ghibli and Spirited Away shortly after that. So this, by comparison to that, I think it's understandable and fair to read it as, you know, more simplistic, straightforward, whatever you want to call it. But just as an adventure movie and as a piece of animation, I just like locked into it immediately. What I think I really glommed onto was just the world. I mean, I've talked before on this podcast how I'm really drawn to complex and detailed world building. And this is a world that has so many levels, literally, like, you know, from the mining town to the castle in the sky to the airships. Like, there's just so much texture to this film in terms of not just setting, but the types of adventure set pieces you get throughout it. I mean this not remotely as an insult, but it felt like the best possible theme park type of movie for me. Like, there's even like the whole mine car chase. It's like, it's a roller coaster, you know. It just had a almost childlike energy that I don't naturally associate with Ghibli films, even though I know they do have films that are much more in this vein. They're just not the Ghiblis that I've seen for the most part. This is all very roundabout way of saying that I really liked Castle in the Sky, and it was a very pleasurable viewing experience for me. If I, you know, revisited it in 5 or 10 years, I could see having a very different reaction to it. But right now, A+.
I feel like Castle in the Sky is just positioned in an interesting place where, like, later Miyazaki movies like Ponyo, for instance, Ponyo focuses on some extremely young kids. Yes. The boy protagonist is 5. The female protagonist is a magical fish girl, so who knows how old she really is. And their relationship is just very, very simple in many places, just kind of like wordless. But the adventure is still very, very surreal and full of dream logic. Totoro is also intended for pretty small children. The kids in that, I think, are 8 and 4, but they're dealing with kind of fantastical dream logic and forest spirits that kind of come and go. And whenever the forest spirits are in their lives, everything takes on this like heightened dreamlike quality. Castle in the Sky doesn't really have that sort of dream quality. And that's sort of what Scott was speaking to.
Yeah.
it feels like almost more like a Disney child adventure. Like there are elements in like that train race where there's a car chasing a train along a disintegrating train trestle and people are shooting at each other from one set of tracks to the other that would not be out of place in Tangled. You know, like that kind of modern Disney manic feel. So in a strange sort of way, this movie feels a lot more like the films of my childhood, like tonally and conceptually in execution. I find it easier to swallow and just maybe less engaging in some ways because it isn't different in the way many Ghibli movies are. But then it goes off into these strange places, not necessarily in terms of execution because it's still an adventure, but emotionally. There's a lot of stuff in this movie that happens that just feels, for lack of a better word, I mean, it's very Miyazaki.
I think that's kind of where I got stuck a little bit because I had just rewatched Spirited Away a couple days before with the family on our family movie night, which is a Friday night. And there's something, that movie is so complete and so lyrical and gentle and kind of like, and you're just getting this the sort of this hypnotic kind of flow of the thing. And I feel like Castle in the Sky ended up frustrating me in a way because it has moments like that. Where it's like, okay, this is Miyazaki as I understand him now. And then those moments give way to a lot of adventure and noise and, you know, Tangled mythology and that sort of thing. So I think it was, maybe it's a me problem or maybe it's about when I'm, you know, how I come at Miyazaki and what my understanding of him is may have created a kind of a roadblock for me to go back and see this as something maybe better than a formative work, as something that stands alone as a great movie.
Yeah, my take on it is I basically just kind of it's just neat. not to really simplify it, but like I just loved it's a thread throughout his movies, all the way up through The Wind Rises. I mean, how much he loves technology and just how machines work and just designing all that stuff. And just I was just sort of hypnotized. Less, I mean, you're right. Something like Spirited Away, which I think is his best movie, has a sort of a hypnotic quality that kind of plays into the themes and everything, but I was kind of hypnotized just by the sheer design and imagination on display here, and that was enough for me. And honestly, I felt like I was kind of having your experience, Scott, where it's like, this is cool thematically, it's just not particularly deep. But I think once you get to Laputa and you get to like sort of the what people want to use it for, what happened with it, what its history was, and what its future might be, you know, I thought that was like, oh, this has kind of been in the background the whole all along. It's kind of being foregrounded now in a way that really works.
Yeah, I mean, I want to be absolutely clear here that I liked Castle in the Sky. I'm worried that people are going to listen to the podcast and think, man, he didn't like, how can you not like, I'm talking relative to some of the other Miyazakis I've seen.
Yeah, welcome to my world, Scott, where mild disagreement is taken as outright loathing and hatred of all that is good.
We've disagreed, we've been less far apart on things and disagreed even harsher.
Well, we've kind of teased around the fact that this is just like a lodestone of Miyazaki themes and ideas. What stands out for you particularly?
What really stood out for me at the end was the idea of society just kind of falling prey to excess, falling, you know, abusing natural resources. I mean, that's certainly a running theme through many of the films as well. But I mean, also just sort of the, you know, like I said, this the awe with which this world is presented, but it's also like a fully functional world. Like you feel like there's an economy here, there's a society. It's like this strange fantasy land that's really grounded in history as we know it and recognizable elements of, in this case, early 20th century, late 19th century culture that have just taken a slightly different turn than they did in our world.
And it's obvious to, I mean, we've already kind of stated it, but the fixation with not just flight, but just transportation, vessels in general, you know, you've got such a variety of them here with not just the airships, but, you know, also the like military diesel train thing. But what's part of that, it's not just like, oh, Miyazaki likes to draw planes. It's like there's such a sense of movement associated with all of those vehicles, I guess, conveyances. Like the actual animation has such a sense of movement in those sequences that I think is just a different type of movement than we see in a lot of Western animation. like just the sequences of them like sort of flying low over the landscape, or even like going through the storm. There's just such dynamism to the way that these planes and airships and whatnot move through the frame that feels very Miyazaki specifically, but it also feels like a touchstone of Ghibli, all of his films for Ghibli, I guess.
So I'm coming off, I wasn't on the last podcast pairing because I was working a 70-hour week pulling together this project for Polygon.com on Studio Ghibli. We had 39 new articles about Studio Ghibli movies, that specifically essays delving into the individual films and some of the series' big themes, and, you know, like one-offs about all of the things that Miyazaki has been reported to hate over the years. And a really interesting excerpt from an upcoming book talking about the battles that Neil Gaiman fought with Harvey Weinstein to preserve the tone of Princess Mononoke when he did the translation for it. But digging into, my big contribution was a piece about Castle in the Sky. And digging into like a lot of the kind of the origins and the subtext of this film, one of the things I found out that I think I'd been aware of previously but had forgotten in the way you do, it felt both like a surprise and like just sort of like rediscovering something that's lived in the background, is that Miyazaki's father was an avionics engineer. And he owned his own flight company that designed and built parts for World War II Zero warplanes. And so Miyazaki grew up around plane designs. He grew up around like engineering questions related to flight. And that's part of where that fascination comes from, but also part of where his like detail-oriented approach to airships comes from. And there's so much of that in this movie, you guys. I mean, so many different kinds of airships, like a giant war dirigible and like a passenger commuter dirigible, and this thing that's basically like a kite with a basket under it, big enough for a couple of kids. There's like a little pirate airship. There's the weird little bug-winged skimmer things that the air pirates get around on. There's just so much delving into different methods of flight.
And a little kite glider.
I like. Yeah, it's just it's kind of fascinating and adorable. It feels like, at times it feels like he sat down with like his Ghibli co-designers, just like, what else could fly? what else could we put in this movie? And of course, the whole story is about a giant flying city in the sky. But the flip side of that coin is that he also grew up with a substantial amount of guilt about his family's participation in the war. You know, his family's participation and potential culpability in creating the machinery of death, essentially. And you see a lot of that coming out in movies like Porco Rosso and The Wind Rises. Like, The Wind Rises specifically deals with the question of, as an avionics engineer designing Zero warplanes, like, what's your responsibility? If you're just like an idealistic creator that wants to make the perfect plane, what's your responsibility? As you know, it's going to be used to kill people in large quantities. And in Castle in the Sky, the disgust at the military is so blatant. It's so painted across the film, not just in the disgust for the villain of the piece, Colonel Muska, but like the army itself is just this disorganized, greedy, violent, perpetually misunderstanding, like a group of looters, basically. They have no chill. You know, they have no morals, they have no organization, and they have no chill.
Is that in the script? They have no chill? I think,
well, I mean, I don't know what it is in the original Japanese. It probably reads better in the original Japanese. But that's one of the big themes for me here, is that he returns a lot, I think, to this idea of the military is basically an organization that takes away people's humanity and drives them to consider murder okay. And that's something that you see in Takahata's Ghibli films as well. It's something you see, like, regardless of who's directing. It's just an overall theme stretching through Ghibli work.
Yeah, I sort of related to that. Another thing that struck me is toward the end when Muska unleashes the weapon of mass destruction, and it's a giant mushroom cloud, and it's I think intentionally evocative of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And it is interesting to me that this was, I'm assuming, being produced simultaneously with Grave of the Fireflies, because Grave of the Fireflies come out like the next year. And that was...
Grave of the Fireflies and Totoro came out the same year. They were actually a double feature in theaters.
Such so, yeah. But anyway, so okay, so there was a little more room between them. And obviously, they're two different directors, but that does also... That's, I think, the legacy of Hiroshima and Nagasaki is something that pops up occasionally in Ghibli films. And to have them in such close proximity in these two films was striking to me.
I haven't seen Grave of the Fireflies, so it's hard for me to...
Well, I wrote about it for that AV Club list of great movies that you can't watch a second time, so I'm not allowed to watch it a second time, alas. But
it's rough. It's very, very emotional. Yeah. And I recommend that you watch it maybe after your daughters have graduated.
Yeah, I was
going
to say, definitely not Friday movie night. But actually, to just quickly segue to an entirely different question, but talking about watching with this with your kids, I have to ask, sub or dub for this film and Ghibli in general?
So, sub. I mean, my child is 9, and that's sub's a way to... I'm sorry, dub. Wow. Not sub, dub. Okay. Dub. Okay. I also think that the voice talent they've done for these is pretty great. I mean, I love you know, Cloris Leachman has a role. It's like the John Ratzenberger of Studio Ghibli dubs, you know? So it's fun seeing her, hearing her and things. So I know... When I saw Princess Mononoke, I saw it subtitled. I think that's the only one I've ever seen subtitled, though. I should probably check them out. But on the other hand, I love like Kiki's Delivery Service. I love Phil Hartman. So great in that movie. So I'd hate to give that up. But I do understand the argument against it, though.
I just find it so distracting to have celebrity voices, like very familiar celebrity voices. And even roles that are incredibly iconic, like Robin Williams is the genie in Aladdin, it pulls me, like I can see their faces so vividly, it pulls me out of the fantasy a little bit. So I'm not a super big fan of dubs solely for the chance to hear celebrity voices in interesting roles. But
this one is James Vanderbeek and Anna Paquin are the two leads.
I watch subtitles, so this is all the voice casting stuff is new to me.
Childless, I watched the dub because I was watching with the kid. Well, I mean, with Isabel on this one, the 12-year-old.
I will say I do think I am normally a super, super hardcore subtitle snob, but the dub voices for G-Kids soundtrack of My Neighbor Totoro is just aces. I think those two little girls are absolutely fantastic. So your mileage may vary.
I feel like, I mean, I'm certainly a snob about subtitles with live action. The animation, I feel like it's more of an edge case, I guess.
Well, I mean, one of the reasons I tend to be a little snobby about it is because it's really pretty typical to produce a fairly direct translation for subs and then to rewrite everything for dubs because you're trying to fit mouth movements. So you're trying to kind of capture the tone of what's being said, but often like taking a 20-word thing and trying to get it into two words.
Oh, yeah. Because there's so many. I was really stood out in this one more than other dubs, how much like there are no periods in these in the dialogue. It's just one sentence running into the next sentence.
Yeah, like I already have a sense when watching with subtitles that like I'm missing a layer because just like some things translate differently and, you know, maybe lose some of their poeticism, you know, in the translation from Japanese to English. So I think my general sense is that by watching with the dub, I would be putting even another layer of remove and adding on a layer of distraction in the recognizable voices aspect. So that's sort of my logic for defaulting to subtitles. Not that I fault anyone, especially young children, for watching the dub version, but as someone who is not watching with small children, I'm pretty strident about the subtitles.
Yeah, I mean, I am too, but it's because I came up on very, very early American dubs, which were often really of indifferent quality.
Did you see Totoro with the Troma distributor at Totoro? That was the first time I watched that movie, and I was still charmed by it, but it was not a high budget, a big budget dubbing situation there.
I'm pretty sure that's the edition I actually still own.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those things, you get a DVD copy, you kind of keep it around, keep it in the mix. Mm. Because it was the first one I encountered, it's the one that sounds familiar to me. Mm. But yeah, G-Kid's version is a lot better. Before we get too far down the rabbit hole of this particular thing, I kind of, in going back to Miyazaki themes and also kind of looping back to You're Wrong, Scott Tobias, chapter 3862, the Tasha Robinson story, one of the things this movie does that is really unusual for a Ghibli film is it's got a villain. It has a villain who doesn't soften, who doesn't turn into an ally or at best like an understandable and harmless threat. You have villains in like pretty scary villains in movies like Spirited Away or Howl's Moving Castle that like literally melt and deform into like small harmless versions of themselves. You have an awful lot of Studio Ghibli movies where there isn't even really a hint of a villain. There's the big villain is sadness, basically. Mm-hmm. The villain is not giving it your all or giving up. So the fact that there's like a full-on bad guy here is unusual. But there's also the Pirate Queen Dola. Who is a very, very typical.
I was like, when are we
Miyazaki
getting to Dola?
So Scott, you got a little lost in the second act as far as you're concerned. Maybe my favorite sequence in the entire film is when the two, we haven't really talked about the plot at all, but in nutshell version, there's a young girl with a legacy attached to this lost flying city in the sky, and she meets a young boy who does his best to protect and save her from various people chasing her, including a band of sky pirates who want to loot the city, and a military that wants to weaponize the city, and Colonel Muska, who has his own plot going on. So there's a sequence where the two kids have kind of signed on with the sky pirates, who still fully intend to exploit them. And Dola, the pirate queen, is just, she's such an unusual character. Like, she is an air pirate queen, but she's also like a fat old lady in bloomers. with one tooth and pink pigtails sticking out the side of her head.
I was gonna say, don't forget the pigtails. That's her signature.
Yeah, even before seeing this movie, I was familiar with those pigtails. That is iconic, I think, character design.
And she's just delightful. You know, she's big. She's a big, loud, over the top character. Like our actual villain, Colonel Muska, is very debonair and dialed down. And like if he had a mustache, it'd be a mustache stroking villain. But he's a tiny glasses villain. She's shoves an entire ham into her face kind of villain. But there's this sequence where the two kids end up in the sort of the crow's nest of the pirate ship together, kind of with their first quiet moment together since all this nonsense started. And they huddle under a blanket together and kind of like catch each other up on what's happened and where they are and how they feel about it. And the entire time, Dola, the pirate queen, is lying in her bed below them, listening in on them through a speaker tube that they don't know is there. And we get to watch as she starts off like just very clearly, avidly listening for anything that she can turn into money. And like slowly, she seems to drift simultaneously towards sleep and towards sympathy with them. And watching her character change in real time as she listens to these two kids, it's such a Miyazaki thing. You know, watching a villain turn into an ally is a thing that he does a lot. But watching it happen beat by beat in real time, kind of coupled with the idea of this very fierce character drifting towards sleep, I find it so beautiful and so tonally exceptional.
Five stars. Scott's wrong.
This is directed at me. I apparently don't like this sequence. Oh, the fact that it takes place in the second act. No, I'm sorry. I like that sequence too. I don't. I don't have much of it. I honestly don't have. I like the movie. I can't really push against that at all. At least that specific moment didn't lose me at that point.
Well, just, I mean, like, what is it in the second act that loses you? I mean, that's where we get like all the robot stuff and like the dialogue in the military fortress and a bunch of stuff like that. Like, what doesn't work for you?
I found myself really having this when do we get to the fireworks factory thing where I was just wanting to them to get to the place.
No, Scott, it's a castle in the sky. It's not a fireworks factory.
Okay.
I mean, there are fireworks there.
Yeah, there are. And once we got there, it's just, you know, the whole thing kind of like snapped into focus again for me. You know, I felt a little bit lost in getting there. And maybe my fault. Maybe just a.
I mean, I think it's a matter of taste because, like, I actually really like the second act, but I will acknowledge that it's busy. You know, you're moving around to a bunch of different places, and there's a lot of plot mechanics that need to click into place before you get to the castle in the sky. So, like, I can kind of see where that feeling is coming from. But as I mentioned before, as someone who is very kind of attracted to world building and finding out more details about this world, I really responded to that portion of the movie because it did just keep like expanding in a really appealing way. And I really kind of loved everything on the Tiger Moth, which is the name of the pirate ship, I guess, just because it did reveal Dola as a different sort of character than I initially assumed her to be. Actually, at first, the comparison point that came to mind for me was Ma Beagle and the Beagle Boys from DuckTales. Very strong,
such a good
Ma Beagle vibes. Yeah, but that aspect of this, all those characters just like unfold in a really interesting way. Her sons too. I mean, they're doofuses throughout the movie, but they become more endearing doofuses during those scenes. So yeah, put me in the Scott's wrong camp, I guess. I'm kidding, Scott. You're
just a little bit wrong. Just a little bit.
Welcome to
my
camp.
You're allowed to be wrong, Scott.
Welcome to my camp. We have cookies and balloons.
So you don't think, I mean, you watch something like this and then Totoro was next, right? I mean, he went from this to Totoro. I mean, Totoro just seems so singular to me as an achievement. Just like, this is like nothing I'd have seen from anyone, you know, certainly of the Japanese animation I'd seen to that point where I was exposed to Totoro. Totoro was like nothing I'd ever seen. The tone of it, the quietness of it, the lyricism, the things I really, you know, the qualities I really love of Miyazaki's, they're not as present here. And
the movie's not quiet enough for you. We get it, Scott. It's too noisy. It's too loud. It's too busy.
It's a very busy movie.
I mean,
I wonder if the subtitle, if the subs people have got something going with this thing, because it's a pretty loud, the voice work is pretty loud in Castle.
I could definitely see that being
especially. God bless Cloris Leachman, but that is not a subtle piece of work.
Oh no, she's great though. I was a little thrown by Vanderbeek doing a little boy voice, but it worked. It ended up fine. I thought he was actually pretty good.
Okay, so here's a question I need some clarification on, because Tasha, I think in your piece on Castle in the Sky, which I read, it was very good.
Thank you.
I'll link it in the description so everyone else can read it. But you make note of the sequence on the Tiger Moth where Dola's sons are kind of putting the moves on Sheeta, you know, and it being creepy because she's a preteen girl. Do we know how old these two characters, Pazu and Sheeta, are? I mean, they're small. They're drawn smaller than everyone else. So I think they register as children. But I have a hard time registering them just through their behavior and what they've endured, what we're told they've endured in their lives, registering them as children. Like, I feel like I'm like processing them maybe in the 17-year-old range more than preteen. And I may have missed something where we hear exactly how old they are, but I'm curious if anyone has a read there.
You know, I certainly don't remember any specific line where we're given ages. For me, it's in the drawings. I mean, there is kind of that.
They are notably shorter than everyone else.
They're shorter and they're rounder. Like their limbs are rounder, their faces are rounder, which usually in anime and manga is like a signifier for for youth and innocence. I mean, I'm thinking about like going back to Tezuka's Astro Boy, like characters like that that are just expressly drawn as little kids because they're so rounded and so big eyed. They're almost like Pinocchio-esque. So for me, it's like their lack of physical development. Mm-hmm. The fact that they're both like the Pazuyu, the boy, doesn't have shoulders really yet. The Shida, the girl, doesn't have any kind of curves at all.
Oh, I think she does. When she puts on those bloomers, I mean, obviously the bloomers give her curves below, but she's like pretty well developed up top. As I noted,
Jeremy, I'm glad you took that observation.
This seems like we're heading into Anthony Lane territory.
Well, I bring it up because it's related to my point I'm making that is like where do these characters fall on the child to adult spectrum? Because like we also get the detail about Shida. Parents dying and her like running the farm in their absence and her apparently doing a pretty good job at it. Like if these characters are meant to be like 11 or so, like good for Shida. But I think like that combined with specifically what her character design looked like on the Tiger Moth in that outfit, I just was like, oh, she's probably like 17.
Yeah, I definitely don't process her as curvy at all in that outfit. I mean, it's very billowy. It's mm-hmm. got big pant legs. It's their harem pants. It's got big poofy sleeves. Mm-hmm. But I definitely don't see her as developed at all. I see them both as little kids. And yeah, it's a little weird that Pazuyu, you know, if he's 11, he's also living alone in an abandoned house. Or like a broken down house that he's very clearly kind of like renovated for himself. He's very capable. But we also get to see him like pursuing Shida as she's dragged around from one place to another by one set of villains after another. And he's very capable. You know, he's very independent. He's very fierce. But he's characterized as a small child. You know, his doggedness and his simplicity of kind of belief and action just all codes like a small child to me. And so do the voices in the mm-hmm. the English dub. I mean, there's no hint of adolescence, I think, in either of those voices. They sound like little kids.
I mean, I'm not sitting here trying to argue that they're adults and we should read them as adults. I find it more interesting that there is a sense of ambiguity because there's a sense of ambiguity about a lot of the specifics of the time and place and whether time even works the same way in this place we are, you know, or if secondary sex characteristics work the same in this world.
I mean, there is sort of the question of where all those large adult pirates sons come from. Dola has this guy that's her mechanic that also kind of looks like a Tezuka character. He's this like short little man with Coke bottle glasses and a giant bristling mustache. And at least in the translation I saw, the old Disney translation, he's referred to as Pops, which mm-hmm. could mean like he is actually all of those pirates' father and that he's Dola's husband, or it could just be like your generic like, hey Pops, you know, the kind of name that you give to any like random ass uncle in your giant extended weird pirate family. But if you decide
we've all got one.
Well, we all want one now, at least. If you decide that Dola and Pops are a couple and they produce those eight kids, it just raises so many questions. It's like spider level sexual dimorphism in terms of like physical size and overall personality.
I feel like we've gone down some rabbit holes here.
We've definitely gone down some rabbit holes. Let's talk about.
I did not expect to be talking about secondary sex characteristics on this podcast. I guess you could say Anna Paquin would have been 4 years older. It would have been 4 years after the piano when mm-hmm. she did the dub for this. So for whatever that's worth,
which would make her what, 12? Wasn't she 8 for the piano?
Yeah, I guess so. She would have been still pretty young.
At the time, she was the youngest Oscar nominee of all time, I believe.
Winner, yeah.
That's the
nominee and winner, or just winner.
I think nominee. But that's his maybe. We're again pretty far off the mark. We should talk at least a little bit about the animation here. You know, there's a pretty wide range of imagery in this movie, like ranging from the incredibly lavish painted backdrops of Laputa, the city in the sky itself, to just some very, very cartoony action. What do you think about the animation? What stands out for you here?
Oh, the colors, for one. I mean, it's really striking looking in that sense, too. But I don't have a great sense of what anime was like in the 70s. Like, I know Speed Racer, and I know Miyazaki is kind of like the person who set the tone and look of, and Ghibli in general, for the 80s. But, you know, maybe, you know more about this than I do, Tasha. What makes this stand out from what else is coming out at the time? And how does it differ from, what is the missing link between the 60s stuff and this?
I mean, I don't think of Miyazaki as that much of like the father of the look of anime at all. I think that rests pretty squarely with Osamu Tezuka.
Yeah, okay. You know more about this than I do, so go.
I've done a lot of writing about this, but it's been a long time. Genevieve?
Well, that's interesting that you bring that up, because I think literally my only other reference point, or my only pre-Ghibli reference point for like Japanese feature animation is Unico, specifically Unico and the Island of Magic, which Tasha is laughing because years and years ago, there was an Ask the AV Club column where people would write in basically trying to ask us to help them remember things they saw from their childhood. And like one in five letters.
It wasn't set up as such. It just turned into that.
Yeah. And like one in five letters was basically about Unico and the Island of Magic, which I think played on the Disney Channel in the early 80s. I think that's probably where I saw it. And
it's to this day, it's unclear if by the end of that, by the time we had like three or so of those, I think people were trolling us, like actively picking scenes from Unico and writing in, hey, does anybody remember what this is? Because every time it turned out to be Unico, I would promise I was going to watch Unico, and I still haven't.
I for some reason own two copies of it, so maybe I'll send you mine. But that's a Tezuka character, right? According to the Wikipedia page I just pulled up, it is.
Well, there you go. I know as little as possible about it. Tezuka, to me, like, I know him from Astro Boy. I know him from some later, like, long-form, sophisticated manga stuff that I have on my shelf. I know him from... I can't remember the Japanese title for it, but it was basically The Jungle King. It was the animal story that became Kimba the White Lion in the U.S. And if you look at the kind of the design for that, like that's your missing link. Mm-hmm. That's your where was like kids anime at the time. And Kimba the White Lion, like I loved that as a kid. It was one of those older cartoons that came on at like 5:30 in the morning in the we paid almost nothing for access to this kind of Saturday morning shows. But it was basically this very big eyed, big headed, big eared, simple line drawing lion that rushed around in the jungle solving disputes between animals and dealing with incursions into the wild. And it was fascinating to me because it wasn't really about people. It was about like the existence of some very, very cartoony animals. But the animation style there, I mean, it was influential. It was so influential and so early that it was actually a huge influence on Miyazaki himself. Mm-hmm. One of our Ghibli Week stories was specifically about the relationship there and how Miyazaki came to a point in his career where he realized that Tezuka had influenced him so much that he didn't feel he had a style of his own. And he just gathered up a whole bunch of his artwork and burned it because he said, like, I've got to start from scratch. I've got to start from general principles if I'm ever going to develop my own style and not just be copying him.
That's really interesting to hear because to go back to Unico and the Island of Magic, the last act of that movie takes place in a castle made out of living puppets, which are basically just people that have been turned into little like black people who are bricks in this castle. And it's very creepy. And there's a roller dragon robot that is very creepy. But there's these elements that I felt like I was seeing echoed in Castle in the Sky, and I'm not suggesting that Miyazaki was referencing this like second in a series of three movies about a magical unicorn, but it made me wonder if these are visual tropes that are more prevalent in Japanese animation that we were seeing play out there.
It could just be like a recurring, Suzuki had a lot of recurring images, like a lot of stylistic, like character types that he returned to over and over, and like kinds of action and kinds of humor. And not to say that he was derivative of himself, because if you read a lot of his stuff, one of the things that's most amazing is how he'd build these very predictable dynamics of a lush, incredibly complicated background and these mm-hmm. incredibly simple foreground figures, like navigating a sort of like Tintin-like landscape where everything is like very, very politically complicated, and yet at the same time like outsized and slapstick and cartoony. So they were both very accessible to children and like fun for adults. The stories would unfold in a Scheherazade type way where there was kind of always another layer to be dug into. He was a master of world building. So it wouldn't surprise me at all if there were sort of visual motifs that this is particularly drawing from, that were kind of recurring images without it being this one specific image. Mm-hmm. But I think only Miyazaki could tell you that.
And he probably wouldn't. from what I know of him.
No, probably not, given how much he worked to exercise Suzuki from his style. Although now I suddenly think I've been saying Suzuki rather than Suzuki. Maybe we should move on before I dig myself in even deeper. Well, we're as so often is the case, like we know it's time to shift subjects because we're narrowing down to some very, very specific things. We always mean to keep these discussions like more general and top view. And then we always like funnel down to smaller and smaller points. So in order to open it back up again, we know that we're going to have a lot more to say about Ghibli's movies in general and how they speak to each other and how Miyazaki developed and the running themes in his work. But in the same way we kind of channeled this conversation into a modified version of our usual dynamic, we're going to channel all of our further recommendations and discussions into a modified version of our normal recommendation segment. So we'll talk about our favorite Ghibli movies and our favorite starting points for the catalog after this. Normally, this is where we talk about what we've been watching lately and would recommend films or film-related items in a segment we call Your Next Picture Show. But this week, we're approaching that from a Ghibli direction, asking everybody to bring in their favorite Ghibli movie and explain why they recommend it. And then we're probably just going to generally talk about them because that's what we do. Keith, you want to kick us off here?
So I mentioned earlier that I think Spirited Away is Miyazaki's best film, and I'm not going to stray from that. And I think a sentimental favorite of mine is My Neighbor Totoro, which was the first I saw, and certainly I think it's the first one we showed our kid when she was, you know, young and just the right age for it, because I think that's a film that plays really well for little kids. And I suppose we'll probably touch on both of those later. But a real favorite of mine is Kiki's Delivery Service. It was one of the earliest ones I saw, and I think it really combines some I'd seen Totoro at that point, and now having seen Castle in the Sky, it really does feel like a synthesis of that kind of, you know, deep investment in characters and storytelling with a sort of elaborate world building and a wonder of technology, and as I mentioned before, it's this wonderful ability to create a sense of an actual working culture that integrates all these amazing elements from different parts of history and different parts of the world into this world unto itself. So I'm a huge fan of that one, but I also find it really moving. And it's not the kind of story it's a coming of age story, but it's not the kind you normally see. I mean, there's the story is about Kiki, who's kind of set off to live by her parents to live on her own, which is itself kind of nothing, you don't see that very often, but it plays out really well. I mean, it kind of captures the terror of what it means to leave home for the first time, but it also has this real gentleness to it. And there's conflict, but as we mentioned before, it's definitely a film without villains. And again, I should at some point watch the subtitled versions, but I know the Disney dub so well. And I think Kirsten Dunst and Phil Hartman and Janine Garofalo especially are such standout performances in those that I just think of those characters as having those voices. Like Janine Garofalo is as the slightly disaffected, it's not the right word, but certainly the sort of the cool role model that Kiki aspires to be is perfectly cast, and I don't know. I'm a big fan of that one. I want to know who isn't. I challenge you to tell me why that's not a great movie. Scott?
I'm not going to challenge you. I have a similar experience with the dub of that. Phil Hartman as the cat in particular just makes me laugh quite a bit, and it is kind of. I mean, there are certain elements of it that are familiar, and that it is. Children's animated films are certainly not short of, you know, coming of age stories, and and this is about a girl who's kind of finding herself and figuring out where her power lies and what kind of person she is, and so all of that plays and is very accessible. And as you know, as we move into this discussion about our recommendations, that is kind of in my mind a little bit, is that accessibility. Thinking about these films as like a child and as a grown up, and like what are your entry points going to be, and what kind of movies you want to see first, and what time ideally in your life would you want to encounter each of these movies? I've been thinking about that a lot lately.
Well, I mean, we showed it to our kid not long after Totoro, because Totoro went so well, and she was really, I mean, she was quite young, I think 4 or 5, and she was kind of really startled by the idea that you know, these parents would send their daughter off to live on their own, but in a way that I felt like was appropriate. It kind of got her thinking about that as a possibility, not to worse than our kid off now to live on her own. At some point, ideally we will, you know, and like, I think he's really good at capturing these sort of these cycles of life and being accepting of them without softening the fact that, you know, things change and there's loss and sadness and in the world. It's part of living.
Kiki's never been one of my favorites, and I think it's because of the order that I encountered these movies in. Like, I don't think it's as pure and joyous and fantastical and wild as My Neighbor Totoro, which I encountered earlier, and it's certainly not as dark and challenging and different as Princess Mononoke. But I saw it like after those two, and it didn't stack up in comparison. And as a result, I haven't revisited it enough. Like, I haven't watched it again, having seen so many other Ghibli movies, and I'm really kind of long overdue for that. But what always struck me about it was just the fascination of a story where effectively the villain, the enemy, is loneliness, and the disaffection that comes with having friends, but feeling that you haven't really fully connected with them. Because Kiki isn't lacking for companionship. She isn't lacking for people to relate to, or even people who treat her in a friendly way or want her in their lives. She's just having problems relating to them. She's having problems feeling that she is where she belongs and kind of understanding who she is and who she needs to be. And she kind of falls into a depressive slump. And it feels like she's going through adolescence. She's experiencing big emotions that she doesn't know what to do with exactly. And that it just seems so well observed, but so ridiculously daring for a movie to make that the big central conflict.
I guess this is the time where I admit Kiki's is one that I haven't seen.
Oh, so, you'll love it. Oh, wow. You'll love it.
Like it.
Yeah. Well,
it's on HBO Max.
I know. Well, it's interesting because I feel like, well, I think I already said this, my Ghibli viewing skews more away from the sort of younger, for lack of a better term. And I was going to try and get through this whole episode without admitting this, but I also haven't seen Totoro. So yeah, those are like the real big holes that I'm looking very forward to filling, because Castle in the Sky kind of put me in the mindset of wanting to like delve deeper into that arm of Ghibli, because the arm of Ghibli I am more familiar with is the one informed by my first Ghibli film, which is Princess Mononoke, and was the one I was going to talk about. But we can finish talking about Kiki's first if there's anyone has anything else left to say.
I mean, I think this can all, you know, melt from one to the other, like some sort of Ghibli villain or something. I will say, if you haven't seen those two, I'd watch Kiki's first, because I think Totoro is the better movie. But I also just think, like, wait and watch Kiki the next time you're feeling just depressed and overwhelmed.
Oh, so you know, tonight, next time, tomorrow?
tonight, right now, you want a piece out of this podcast, watch it and come back. We could still be talking. There's a lot to cover. But yeah, like, you know, anytime that you're feeling overwhelmed or just like kind of weighed down by the world, or I don't know, like sealed into a home and unable to see your friends and thus feeling emotionally and socially distant from them, like, it's a really good movie for addressing all those feelings.
Totoro, on the other hand, they're all good for that.
Yeah, Totoro, on the other hand, is just pure, unadulterated joy. But we'll get to that. Why don't we talk about Princess Mononoke first?
Not pure, unadulterated joy.
No. And kind of like continuing the theme of accessibility based on where you are in your life when you first experienced Ghibli. I saw Princess Mononoke in the theater during the, I think it was the 2000, they released it in theaters with the dub. I think they also did a sub. In my mind, I saw the subtitled version in the theater, but I think I probably saw the dubbed version. We'll just let my memory have that. But I was a teenager. I was like 16, 17. I had just like been starting to dip my toes into anime. I was briefly a member of my high school's anime club. You know, so Mononoke like coming out in theaters was a big deal, you know, and it was like I drove a half hour to go to the art house theater to see it. And it's such a knotty and narratively complex and morally complex film that encountering it at that point in my life, where most of my frame of reference for animation was Disney and Western animation and just a very different mode of storytelling, Mononoke just really blew me away. Just like, oh, this is like an entirely different way that animated movies can be, you know? And the two things have always stuck with me about it. I revisited it for this podcast, and yes, it's still very, very good. I can see where people could pick out flaws, and it is not necessarily the Ghibli movie I would recommend people seek out right now if it doesn't already sound like something they would be interested in. But the two things that always stick out to me are the opening sequence with the boar that has the bullet lodged in it and is just basically engulfed in these undulating worm things. It's terrifying. It's a terrifying opening. And I think it maybe like inured me to some of the more squicky Ghibli imagery throughout the filmography that I encountered in subsequent movies. Like nothing reaches the level of that opening sequence. And honestly, the climax of Mononoke too, it's very squirmy for me anyway. And I imagine for little kids, this is not a introduce your kids to Ghibli film by any means.
This was a failed family movie night. We got past the boar. I had not seen this since it was in American theaters, 20 years, I guess, before I tried to show it on family movie night. I like, guys, this is PG-13, so it's going to be a little more intense than like Totoro. And then, but like, you know, my kids seen the Marvel movies, other PG-13 movies. And like, we get past the boar, sort of, barely, but you know, it's fine. Then we get to the beheadings. I'm like, oh, this is not working at all.
Yeah, it's definitely violent.
Yeah, there's some very early limb loss, as I recall.
Yes, quite.
Yeah, like double arm.
Yes.
I think Star Warsization is the term for that. sudden explosive severing of limbs.
Yes.
Well, arms, specifically.
But the other thing, other than the violence, the Scott's beloved violence that sticks out to me, is the villain, Lady Eboshi, who is... I'm sure arguments could be made for more complex villains throughout Ghibli's filmography, but I just find her fascinating and just really indicative of the film's eagerness to explore the morality of humanity's relationship with the natural world. Lady Eboshi is the founder lady of Iron Town and is basically... She is the reason that the spirit world is in upheaval, which is sort of the framing of the movie. And she is actively trying to kill these spirits for reasons. But she's also a woman who has created a place for sex workers to earn a living and be protected from men. And she's a woman who has given shelter and purpose to lepers. And she has created a sort of utopia. Like, if you squint, you could think of it as a utopia, but she has done it at great expense and at great cost. So I just find her as a character she's not the main character, but she is what sticks out to me most when I think of Mononoke.
That character in particular, like, a lot of people have hesitated even to call her a villain.
Yeah.
And, like, she's certainly closer to it than most Ghibli films have, but she's, I think, the primary reason that people ask Miyazaki in interviews, like a lot of George R. R. Martin questions, you know, like, why are your villains so complex? Why don't you believe in black and white? Who's the good guy in here and who's the bad guy? What are you trying to say about morality? Like, all these questions that are really, really familiar from people interviewing Martin about Game of Thrones. Miyazaki got them first because of characters like this. There's a clip of John Lasseter interviewing Miyazaki for when Miyazaki won a special achievement Oscar, where he asks this question. And Miyazaki's just basically like, yeah, you know, I create a villain and then I come to sympathize with them. Like, I like them. I think the villains work really, I'm very, very paraphrasing here, but he talks about the old Superman Fleischer Brothers cartoons and how there's a villain in that who's like built an entire secret base like under the Hollywood Hills. And he's like, anybody who works that hard is lovable, like deserves sympathy. Yeah. The villains work so much harder than the good guys do. So like, I think fundamentally he wants to see things as much more pluralistic and complicated than hero villain, which, you know, is an exciting thing for somebody raised on Disney cartoons and just like American media in general, where things tend to be very, very black and white.
Yeah, it definitely blew me away in 2000. And I think, as I've mentioned a couple times, sort of colored my perception of what Studio Ghibli did for a long time. And I'm still sort of filling out that perception. And speaking of which, let's talk about a movie I haven't seen, Scott.
I wanted to talk about My Neighbor Totoro. It was my first Ghibli film. It was a movie that I heard about first from an episode of Siskel and Ebert. It was a split decision on My Neighbor Totoro, which is just insane to think about. But I remember looking at, but they were showing like the cat bus sequence, like the really famous, you know, one of the great sequences
even seen the cat bus sequence.
Absolutely stunning. And they were showing that as like a clip. It was like, holy crap, this looks incredible. Like, I don't know whether, you know, they seemed, you know, lukewarm on it. But like just watching that, it was like, this looks pretty amazing. So I checked it out and found it to be quite remarkable. But it stands out to me personally as it's just an extremely special film as a parent, because it was my now 12-year-old daughter we showed it to her when she was maybe 3 or 4, and it was her favorite movie. Period. And she saw it early enough to where she doesn't even remember now, but it really kind of, the fact that she embraced it so much at that age speaks to kind of the uniqueness, I guess, of the language in which this movie, the uniqueness of which Miyazaki sort of operates in this film, because it really is much more abstract than what she was being exposed to from something like Disney, which would give you a pretty traditional narrative. You're having to, you know, it has a cat bus and it has Totoro and it has a lot of interesting things going on with nature, and it's really sophisticated, but it's also, I think, at a really young age, your mind is not, you're still developing, and you're able to kind of readily accept, dream logic or abstraction in a way that a more calcified brain, you know, might resist, and so to kind of experience the film in that context and through her eyes and her enthusiasm made it all the more special to me. This is certainly right up there among my favorites. Genevieve, I think you're going to like it quite a bit. So you'll want to check it out soon. But I don't know what to say. I mean, it's got, you know, the cat bus is a standout, but it's also, you know, it's about moving to a new place and making some difficult adjustments and finding a new friend. And it's about being a good, being siblings, which is another thing that was resonant with me as a father of two. I love it. It's kind of a perfect movie.
So one of the other things I unearthed when I was doing Ghibli Week research was that Miyazaki's mother had tuberculosis and spent a large part of his childhood in the hospital, apparently 9 years in and out of hospitals as he was growing up. And that's very strongly reflected here as the two little girls deal with the fact that their mother is away and her health keeps turning for the worse. And they're not really in on the story exactly. They know that they're getting kind of a ghost of the story that the adults are getting. They don't always know what they don't know or how to translate what they do know. And that also became one of Miyazaki's big themes. You know, his movies are just fascinated with disease, the disease curse that's spreading and killing people and animals in Princess Mononoke, or just like everything that gets cursed and diseased and rotting in Spirited Away. Howl and Howl's Moving Castle has basically is magic is becoming a disease for him. Like with a lot of these movies, greed or desire for power becomes a form of disease that takes on disease-like aspects. And this movie like turns it into a children's story, like turns it into the kind of sort of distant echo of, you know, something's wrong and you know that you're not getting the full story and you know that the adults are dealing with something much bigger than you are, but you still have to go off and be a kid sometimes. And there's so many aspects of Totoro that are just so finely emotionally tuned that, that feel so authentically like childhood. I think seeing it for the first time, that was what struck me more than anything, just because, again, I was used to having the experience of childhood fed back to me in a very like heightened and brightened, false cartoony kind of way from a lot of American media, both animated and like even more so with like Disney live action features, where the kids were all like sort of creepily like bright and precocious and loud. And the way Mae feels like a real 4-year-old here, I think is just remarkable. Mm-hmm. You know, and her little like storms of emotion, of like joy and excitement and sulky petulance, and how cranky she gets when she's tired and how easily she's delighted when something unexpected happens. These kids just feel so much like kids to me.
The other thing too, that you, now that you mention it, Tasha, is that this film and Ponyo and Kiki's Delivery Service, I mean, these are films about you know, a single parent who's kind of in charge, right? I mean, like, not single, but it was single parent, a couple of, but just like the idea of kids who are not, don't have helicopter parents, who don't have eyes on them all the time, and who have to kind of find their way out into the world and discover things on their own, and maybe, you know, go outside of the bounds that a more attentive parent or would allow them to go. And so that feeling of discovery and danger is a part of these movies too.
I think that also applies to your pick, Tasha, in terms of
right. And of course, your pick, the parents disappear at a certain point, right? Pretty early.
Yeah, Spirited Away. I have to talk about it. I'm kind of obsessed with Spirited Away. I wrote a gigantic piece about it at the Dissolve. That's still, knock on wood, available on the internets.
And it was a movie of the week. We did a few things. It was a movie of the week. We did a few things on it.
Yeah, we did a bunch. But like this is one of the cases where I just like obsessively delved into one aspect of a film I was fascinated with. And, you know, it was a kind of like film scholar thing that we could do at the Dissolve that we often couldn't do anywhere else. It's just like chase that obsession. In this case, just the degree to which fluid is a thing in that movie. Spirited Away is about a young girl who's, again, her family is moving to a new place, and much like in Totoro. And again, she's disaffected and feeling very separated from her friends, as with Kiki. And she's falling into a depression, as with Kiki. And then her parents get turned into pigs and she gets stuck in the spirit world and has to work her way out.
As with Mononoke, kind of. I just want to link yours to all three of ours.
I mean, to some degree, like Ashitaka does kind of get like hauled into a spirit world that he did not sign up for, that he has to kind of fight his way, earn his way back out of. Yep. So yeah, for sure. But this movie, like, also, I think, gets at some of the feelings of childhood, like the stormy, sudden petulance of teenage, like tweenage slash teenage life, and that feeling that nobody understands you, and the kind of like grumpy petulance of having to work when, like, having any kind of chores just feels like the biggest labor. And then suddenly being thrust into a much bigger world where everything depends on you. Like, that is kind of the nut of a lot of child films, mm-hmm. is like the adults can't be relied on, so the kid has to save the day. But in this case, it's just so threatening and so overwhelming and terrifying. And the movie really lets you feel that. Like, it's not a fun romp through being the one who has to save the day and be brave. It's really authentically frightening, and that makes it even more exciting and uplifting when the main character, like, bit by bit finds her spine and, like, learns to navigate the things that make her afraid, because she's navigating them for somebody else. You know, she's trying to help other people. I don't even, in some ways, know where to start about this movie, because I'm so fascinated with every aspect of it. It's another kind of misshapen episodic story that goes from chapter to chapter. And there are through lines about kind of the fairy tale importance of being kind to strangers and being, like, open and honest and good natured and good hearted. But there are so many different weird moving pieces to it. And so many of them are just these incredibly busy Rococo kind of sequences. And the animation is so unbelievably, like, lush and heavy and detailed. I feel like you could write so many dissertations about so many different aspects of this movie. It's so unbelievably rich. But it's a movie that builds up in complexity and builds up in complexity and, like, loudness and visual noise and gunkiness and grossness and terror. And then it all washes away and simplifies down to this one very quiet lyrical sequence that's one of Ghibli's best sequences of all time, I think.
You're speaking of the train.
I'm speaking of the train, although, yeah, you know, something
for another mode of conveyance. We've got a cat bus, got a dream train.
Yeah, actually, one of the, I could keep coming back to a Ghibli week at Polygon all day, because it's still very fresh for me, and I was really, really proud of some of the pretty smart insight that people brought to my fascination with Ghibli movies. But Monica Castillo is a critic for RogerEbert.com and a lot of other places, who I've spent a bunch of time with at film festivals. She's just really incisive and a very sharp writer, wrote a piece for us about transportation in Ghibli and about how obsessed Miyazaki in particular is with it, but how it's very often used to kind of explore these between times, you know, the beat between one big thing and another big thing, and how it's often kind of like a reset of tension, a reset of stakes, a reset of story energy. It's kind of used as this, like, transition point between the great overwhelming thing and the next great overwhelming thing. And that's certainly true here.
I didn't want to talk about Spirited Away because I knew, like, you had your claim on Spirited Away. So, but, like, if we had to actually, like, if this was actually our favorite Ghibli movie, it would obviously be Spirited Away, you know? But, yeah. So I kind of took the directive to be more sort of our entry point to Ghibli. But, you know, seeing it after Princess Mononoke, you know, I kind of already mentioned it, but the, you know, the sort of gross fluid aspects of Spirited Away, I feel probably would have thrown me a lot more if I hadn't already experienced Mononoke, because they're, you know, and also, like, the little sprites, the little coal sprites in Spirited Away, you know, there's so much creepier forest sprites in Mononoke too. So I definitely feel like, because Mononoke was like 3 years before Spirited Away, 2, 4 maybe. So I feel like you can definitely kind of see the some transition points between those two movies.
I love when the Cole sprites decide by observing her that they don't have to carry the coal anymore, and so they just collapse under the coal for a while. This is the one I just saw it a few days ago with the family, and it's just so mesmerizing. The thing just flows beautifully from the start. There's just, and it's a long film. It doesn't feel long.
All of these movies are pretty long for kids' movies.
Maybe episodic, but it's not like but there's, you don't feel like you're getting jerked around. It's just everything moves. Whatever those episodes might be, they segue into the next thing very nicely. I love it, and I think it also, it's animated by this kindness and generosity and humility and there's all these like qualities that the film champions as being, you know, world saving qualities. As somebody, is this girl who comes into this scary place not knowing anything about how it works, and we're learning right along with her what this strange place is, that is a bathhouse for spirits of all kinds. Including one extremely
some
gross
of them.
One.
I mean, there's an entire bucket of giant ducklings for some reason.
Yeah,
there's the naked radish spirit.
I love the giant ducklings are amazing, but I don't know. Her kindness and her bravery. I mean, it's just touching. It's touching to watch, you know. Your sense of self-sacrifice and wanting to help others. I mean, it's a very wholesome film in that respect, and in a film that from a values perspective is wins you over right along with just being a stunning piece of art.
One thing I want to touch on before we leave the topic is I love having these movies on a streaming service at a push of a button. Although I have a lot of these on disc. Which look great, but I really do like that GKids has had this annual tradition. Of course, everything's up in the air now with theaters closed for the coronavirus, but I love this annual tradition of presenting them on a weekly basis in theaters. It's been lovely to get a chance to see some of these in theaters. We saw Totoro at the music. This was a different presentation, but we saw Totoro at the Music Box, and it was such a wonderful mix of parents and kids and just people who like Studio Ghibli movies. And there was this one group of probably 18, 19-year-old college-age women who clearly was the film they'd grown up watching and were seeing it for the first time in the theater. And they were just excited and knew, you could tell they knew every beat of it. And it was just a wonderful thing to witness. And I love that this animation style that's very different, this storytelling style that's very different than what we're used to in the West is just so winning and gets you on its wavelength so easily because it's so well done and touches on such universal themes. I love to see that becoming a tradition, like a theater going, I think film going tradition, and just sort of a these are the films you watch when you're growing up. If you want to show your kids great movies, these are the ones you show them. I love to see that happen over the last couple of decades, and you couldn't necessarily have predicted that because foreign films, animation or otherwise. Tend to be on the margins of American viewing.
One other thing I just wanted to acknowledge before we wrap up is that we have only talked about Miyazaki films here, right. And Ghibli is not just Hayao Miyazaki. It's several directors, but the other one who we mentioned is Isao Takahata, who has made several great films, none of which we talked about at length, and I don't think we have the time to do it, but does anyone just want to give a shout out to any non-Miyazakis real quick?
I'll give a specific shout out to possibly the least challenging of them. I find like his more stylistically experimental films like The Tale of Princess Kiyuga, mm-hmm. and My Neighbors the Yamadas, I find harder to get into. Like, I respect them on a technical level and on a storytelling level, but I just don't feel like the emotional attachment to them that I do to Miyazaki's films. Mm-hmm. But he directed this one movie called Pompoko.
I knew it was going to be Pompoko.
how could it not be? It's about a bunch of tanuki, which people call them raccoons or raccoon dogs, for lack of a good translation. But it's a very specific animal species that lives in Japan, and they have a reputation as being trickster gods, like foxes or cats. And they're supposed to be shapeshifters. They're usually depicted with gigantic testicles. Because they're sort of fertility gods and sort of like hedonistic trickster gods. They like to drink, they like to fool people, and they change shape. So the story is about a little group of tanuki who are being driven out of their home by human expansionism and industrialism. And they kind of try to find a way to make the humans relent. And it very deliberately, very consciously snaps back and forth from this like opening of Watership Down-esque like photorealism views of nature and these animals to this extremely rounded, like cartoony style. And it goes back and forth throughout, like reminding us this is a fun story. But these are very real issues. You know, the lives of these animals matter, and it's just very difficult to see the wilds disappearing. It's a very Miyazaki film. But it's also a big, colorful, crazy one, because they're shapeshifters, and they try to use their shapeshifting to save themselves and to bring humanity to a better awareness of them. And they try all of these strange little tricks, and eventually they literally put on a show trying to make humanity see what it's doing to them. And it's like, when I first saw it, I thought, this is never going to come to America. American audiences are just never going to, Disney is never going to release a movie where all of the characters have visible testicles. they're running around with their nads hanging out, and it's a traditional depiction. Like, they're there for a reason, but you know, for American audiences who are very squeamish about bodies and about nudity, if not about violence, it's a much harder sell. And then they use their transforming power to turn their testicles into rugs and riding beasts and parachutes, and it's an odd film.
Now, how realistic is this? Does this actually happen?
I mean, yeah, but you're not, you know, it's kind of like the mating habits of great white sharks. Like, we know it's all real, but you're not very likely to see it or catch it on film.
Sure.
Because it's all done, like, off in the wilds in places we don't go. But yeah, it's basically a nature documentary, Keith.
Speaking of Ghibli films that Disney is not going to release, the other big Takahata one, which I briefly mentioned, is Grave of the Fireflies, which I don't think ever had a U.S. release. I could be wrong there.
In theaters? Or
yeah.
This is a video store when I worked at the video store.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah.
I saw it in a theater in America, okay. But it was an art house, right. Like one-off kind of special viewing.
Yeah, but you know,
I don't think it had like a wide Disney style release.
Yeah, but you know, watching children slowly dying of starvation in the aftermath of World War II firebombing is, you know, probably a harder sell for Disney.
This is HBO Max, though.
Yeah, I know. So, but is it on HBO Max, or is Hulu still have the rights there? Yeah, it's a good film. It's one that I can't really recommend to people unless you're like just really feeling like some misery right now. But if you are, it's great for that.
I mean, it's heartbreaking, but yeah. it is beautifully realized. Mm-hmm. You know, the action is very vivid, and the characterization, again, is just very, very high quality. There's a little girl in it that is way too much like Mei in Totoro, mm-hmm. and like watching her suffering and starving is not an easy thing to watch. But in the same sort of way, she's just, the way she's characterized is so real and so recognizable and so true to childhood. Like, this is a heartbreaking movie because these kids feel like actual children.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, navigating a terrible time in history, and representing a whole like lost generation.
Well, on that happy note.
Yeah, that's a super downer way to go out. Maybe
that's how
maybe,
we do it here at the Next Picture Show.
Maybe just in an effort to. Oh, so well, again, I don't want to go on and on about Ghibli Week, except that I learned so much from it. You know, I learned so much from these really smart writers going out and challenging themselves to find new things about Ghibli. And the essay that we did about Takahata and his like relentless risk-taking, I think was a really smart and incisive look into, like, into his history and into his motivations and into why it would take him 8 years to make a film. Like, he was even more of a perfectionist than Miyazaki. So I highly recommend that if you're looking for more insight into, like, Takahata as a person. He's so much less publicized than Miyazaki mm-hmm. because his films were more challenging and he didn't have as much of a signature visual or narrative style as Miyazaki. It was never as easy to get into his films or to track the specific fascinations he had. But he was a really strongly individualistic creator, and like that's the kind of thing we love around here.
I think our listeners should just check out the entire Studio Ghibli package on Polygon because it's not just simply a collection of essays, which with plenty of those, but also a broad contextualization and history of the studio as well. So it gives you the big picture as well as a lot of smaller, more idiosyncratic pieces as well. And I think it's a masterpiece, Tasha. I thought you really knocked it out of the park. And I think it's one of those things that can be there and that readers can access as they continue to kind of catch up with and learn about Ghibli films. It's going to be there for people to see.
Well, thank you, Scott. I appreciate that. And in the same spirit, I encourage people through whatever form of access they have in their hometowns, home countries, to dig like deep into the Ghibli catalog and watch as many of these films as possible. You may want to save your My Neighbor Totoro's and your Spirited Away's either for last or for a rewatch. But it's just really rewarding digging into the full catalog and just seeing the incredible range of styles and storytelling and topics and tones and animation styles and experiments on offer there. You can find these films on DVD and Blu-ray from G-Kids for digital purchase or rental at the usual outlets, on HBO Max in the United States, or on Netflix outside the States. So that's it for this special one-off edition of the Next Picture Show. Our next pairing will come out June 23rd and 30th. Scott, what is coming up next?
The new Spike Lee Vietnam epic, To Five Bloods, premiered on Netflix this month. And like many Spike Lee joints, it's full of references to history, culture, and, of course, the movies, including Apocalypse Now, Kelly's Heroes, Platoon, and The Seven Samurai. But its story about four Vietnam veterans who return to the country in search of a fortune and buried gold most strongly recalls John Huston's 1948 adventure, Treasure of the Sierra Madre. On our next pair of episodes, we'll compare and contrast Treasure of the Sierra Madre and To Five Bloods and look at how greed and suspicion caused the bond between men to fray. To Five Bloods is on Netflix, and if you can figure out whether or not you have HBO Max, the Treasure of Sierra Madre is on there now, too. Please join us.
In the meantime, we'd love to hear your feedback on this week's discussion of Studio Ghibli's work and anything else film-related you'd like to talk about. We want to include your thoughts on future episodes of the show. You can leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 or email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. We may post your response on Facebook for discussion or read it on a future episode of the show. Finally, before we close out this week's episode, where can we find everyone these days? Genevieve.
I am the deputy TV editor at vulture.com, and you can find me on Twitter at Genevieve Koski. Keith?
I'm a freelance writer. You can find me on Twitter at kfip3000. You can find me on various websites such as Vulture, The Ringer, Fangoria, TV Guide, Rolling Stone. I'm all over the place. Scott, how about you?
Well, you can find me at home still. I'm at home all the time. And we'll be here for months and months and months. You can also find me on Twitter at Scott_Tobias. And you can find my work at the New York Times, Washington Post, The Ringer, Guardian, and Vulture. Tasha?
I am the film and TV editor at Polygon.com. You can find my work on Studio Ghibli as both writer and a curator there. You can find me on Twitter at Tasha Robinson. You can stay updated on the Next Picture Show by visiting nextpictureshow.net, via Twitter at nextpicturepod, and via Facebook at facebook.com/nextpictureshow. You can contribute to our Patreon and get bonus content, including more about when to show your children certain films and when to not show your children certain films at patreon.com/nextpictureshow. And if you haven't subscribed to the show on Apple Podcasts already, please consider it. Apple Podcast subscriptions are an important part of getting podcasts more prominence and more listeners. While you're there, we appreciate every rating and review. Every thumbs up helps us find new listeners and keep the show going. Thanks to Dan the Snake Jakes for his assistance in producing this podcast. The Next Picture Show is proud to be part of the Film Spotting family of podcasts. Please tune in next time.